We'll hear now in the case of Hollander against Brown. Mr. Rosen.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Donald Rosen, on behalf of Jackie Hollander, the appellant. Your Honors, in 1988, James Brown brutally raped Jackie Hollander. In 2003, Jackie Hollander received the notification of the first injuries that came from that rape.
Obviously not the first injuries. She could have sued in 1988. Being raped is a thing that can lead to damages. So the big question here is, what does state law provide? I take it that the parties have agreed implicitly that Illinois law governs, even though the rape occurred in South Carolina, or it's alleged to have occurred in South Carolina. What does Illinois law say about the period of limitations for rape? The peculiarity I found in both sides' briefs is that neither side cites any cases involving rape. The closest one comes is child molestation, but
that's
your argument, Mr. Rosen, is essentially that Illinois does not have a statute of limitations for tort suits following rape. And
that's
one would expect that to be supported by a citation. Are there any state cases on this question?
No, Your Honor, there are not. Not specifically on
point. Are
there
any cases in other states that use the same general principles as Illinois, for which we could look for analogy?
Not that my research has found, Your Honor.
We got 54 states. There must be some. You know, it's 50 states plus four other state-like jurisdictions. There must be some that have...
D.C. would be very happy, though, to hear you say that.
Pardon?
I say the District of Columbia would be very happy to hear you.
The District of Columbia, the Commonwealth
state.
Of Puerto Rico,
yeah.
Right, the Commonwealth of the Virgin Islands, and then we've got Guam. Anyway.
Respectfully, Your Honor.
Do you happen to know what the law is in Guam on this?
I appreciate your take on this, and I certainly agree that if there are other states that have precedent that we haven't uncovered that possibly we could or should have, that might have made a difference.
But, you know, then if you can't find the specific, let's say, rape or sexual assault, usually you characterize it in a slightly more general way. And I have trouble not characterizing rape as, among other things, battery. It's all of those matters, and you can't possibly say that there aren't Illinois tort cases about batteries.
Of course not, Your Honor. I'd never have said that.
And so, that's a two-year statute of limitations. You know you're injured at the moment the person batters you, if you will, commits the battery. And maybe you don't know that one of the injuries, aside from the offensive physical touching and the like and the emotional damages that result therefrom. One of the injuries in her case is allegedly contracting Graves' disease, but you don't need to, Illinois has said you don't need to know the extent. You just need to know the fact.
Respectfully, Your Honor, that is not exactly what Illinois law says. First of all, as was provided, there is a corollary in terms of statute that I provided to the court under 28J with regard to childhood sexual attacks.
But that statute actually, I think, hurts you because it's a new statute which deviates from the common normal rule in Illinois about when you need to bring cases. It specifically addresses the case of a minor. I don't see anything in this record to suggest that Ms. Hollander was a minor at the time this happened, so
no,
I don't see analogy to that. And the fact that they needed to pass a law to create this different rule for that subset of cases suggests to me that the regular rule in Illinois is that it's 2 years.
The law was needed in order to prevent the obfuscation of the discovery rule, which is what this case is all about. The fact is that your presumption, respectfully, Your Honor, that assault, rape, and anything else that deals with a battery should fall under that 2-year rubric of the statute of limitations is naive. The fact of the matter is that rape is a different animal.
Well,
no,
but I come back to my question. You're making a proposition of state law. We're just here as ventriloquist dummies. We're not trying to decide whether rape is different in some respect. We need evidence that Illinois has decided that rape is different. And without any citation of a single rape case in Illinois or any other jurisdiction, how can we say as a positive matter that Illinois has so decided?
Because regardless, the injury under the discovery rule did not manifest itself until 2003.
No, under the your argument is that this particular injury did not manifest itself. But there is no doubt, this is where we began, there is no doubt that your client could have sued and recovered damages for injuries sustained in a rape.
Your Honor.
You certainly don't have any Illinois case saying, unless you have any injury other than the sexual assault, you can't sue. You get no damages. That's not the rule in Illinois, is it?
No, Your Honor. But regardless, the rule in Illinois is that the discovery rule applies only if the injury is discovered later. The Gola case, the Hyen case, every case that was relied upon by the district court in making this decision was relied upon based on a continuum of injury, where they were injured in the beginning and the injury got worse.
Well, but those are cases where the person wasn't really able to perceive that there was a legally cognizable injury. Under your theory, there's never any closure in a tort case in Illinois because you sue in year 2 for the injuries you've found so far, and then maybe some doctor tells you 10 years later that there's another injury, so you go back and sue for that one, and then somebody else finds another injury. They're all open books, I think, on your theory, and I don't see the Illinois Supreme Court, as I read their cases, saying that.
Even if that were the case, this was a question of fact that the district court should not have substituted.
No, it's a question of what the legal rule is in Illinois. Let's take a simple battery case. Somebody comes up to your client, punches him in the nose, and breaks his nose, right? And his nose heals so that it looks just like it always did. And then 10 years later, a doctor tells him that he has post-traumatic stress disorder attributable to this battery. Can he sue 10 years later if he didn't sue when his nose was broken?
Yes.
Well, what state case do you rely on for that proposition? What's your best case in Illinois for that proposition?
The best case for that proposition are actually the cases. Well, there's the Hill case that we cited, which dealt with injuries that the plaintiff did not know about until later on, such as toxic waste cases. If you don't know about the injury...
Look, I am looking for a case, Judge Wood is obviously looking for it too, where there is a discrete, an observable tort and a discrete injury instantly. Person chooses not to sue. Then he learns more than 2 years later about a second loss and then sues. That's what we're looking for, not cases where the person did not know of any injury at the time and learned about the injury for the first time years later.
Well, I believe that would be Hill. In the Hill case regarding the the malpractice of the doctor, where the patient did not learn until later on. We cited that. We also cited the Braidwood case, which dealt with that. Now, neither of those cases dealt with rape per se. I see I need to leave some time for rebuttal, so thank you.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, Mr. Rosen. Ms. Wade.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Tammy Wade, and I represent the appellees James Brown and James Brown Enterprises. Today we ask this court to affirm the judgment below for the reasons stated in our brief. I'd like to address the reasons today set forth by appellant that the district court's decision should be overturned. First, I'll address whether the district court properly applied the sudden and traumatic standard in determining when the statute of limitations begins to run.
Well, the district judge made one odd step, which was that this was decided under Rule 12b-6. Now, the statute of limitations is an affirmative defense. How can this properly be decided under Rule 12b-6? We keep saying over and over and over that affirmative defenses shouldn't, and in most cases can't, be decided under Rule 12b-6. Now, of course, your adversary makes nothing whatsoever of this, but it was, after all, your motion. Right? Why would the existence of an affirmative defense imply that the complaint doesn't state a claim?
In this instance, Your Honor, the plaintiff affirmatively pled herself out of a cause of action. She stated the incident as in 1988, and Illinois courts have shown that if only one conclusion can be drawn from the undisputed facts, then the timeliness of a complaint becomes a question of law for the trial court to determine, which is what we have in this instance.
The only thing I would add to Judge Easterbrook's point is there are federal cases that have sometimes allowed this to happen under Rule 12b-6, but it's unequivocally the case that the right way to do this is to file an answer in which you raise the affirmative defense and move under 12c, which is another way of getting this done without a lot of discovery and the rest of it. The case would be absolutely right for a motion for judgment on the pleadings at that time, because you would have a complete set of pleadings. You would have answered, deny what you want to deny, raise whatever affirmative defenses. Maybe there'd be others. I don't know. But the problem is that people, often in diversity cases, get confused between the pleading standards in Illinois, which are quite different from the federal pleading standards. Illinois is a fact-pleading jurisdiction. So a lot of things that Illinois courts say about what's supposed to be in the pleadings and what isn't are of no pertinence to federal litigation. In any event, the question here is whether we overlook the fact that this really ought to have come up under this other way, or whether we just go ahead and decide.
Right, and Your Honor, we, like I mentioned earlier, because the plaintiff in this particular case pled an incident that occurred in 1988, it was very clear that applying Illinois law, that her claim was untimely.
And why was Illinois law the correct? Is there any difference between Illinois law and South Carolina law with respect to this? Because I find it hard to believe that the courts of Illinois, if asked, would apply Illinois law to this incident that seems to have happened in South Carolina.
Actually, the statutes of limitations for South Carolina are very similar to Illinois. In that, for an intentional tort, it's 2 years, and negligence, it's 3 years.
And the elements and the way they operate with respect to sexual assaults are also the same?
Yes, Your Honor. Just as in Illinois, the courts look to the nature of the injury. And in this instance, it was rape. It wasn't a Graves' disease. It wasn't any injury that maybe at one point down the road could possibly be linked. It was the invasion of this woman's interest. And at that point, the statute of limitations began to run, whether we're in Illinois or in South Carolina.
Now, she seems to be making an argument that because he was threatening her with death if she told anybody about it, that she should be excused from the two-year filing requirement on an equitable estoppel ground, at least as I understand it. And I didn't think that had anything much to do with the discovery of the Graves' disease. I thought that was more just an argument that if somebody's threatening to shoot you, if you go into court, you're allowed not to be shot.
Right. And, you know, the fact is the appellant never alleged in her complaint any of the elements of coercion.
But she doesn't have to. I mean, if there's any set of facts consistent with the complaint that she could prove, you don't have to allege all the niceties of an equitable estoppel in the complaint.
There's just no precedence in Illinois for establishing tolling based on a plaintiff's fear of retaliation. In this instance, the plaintiff fixed her issues and controversies and the theories upon which she was seeking recovery in her complaint. And any unpled claim or theory doesn't preclude judgment on the pleadings as a matter of law.
Okay.
And as far as the discovery rule, as counsel argued, the discovery rule is applicable when there is one discrete incident of unlawful conduct, and that's the point of reference that the courts look to determine when the statute of limitations begins to run. The Hill case that counsel referred to is actually different than the case at hand, because in that case it was a cancer patient who was getting chemotherapy radiation treatments for one cause. She was injured during that and later discovered that the injury was as a result. That case is different because it wasn't a sudden traumatic event from which the statute of limitations begins. So we just ask that the court affirm the dismissal for failure to state a claim because on the allegations in appellant's complaint, there's no set of facts exist which would entitle her to relief as her claim was untimely.
Thank you, Ms. Wade. Anything further, Mr. Rosen?
Yes, Your Honor.
You have about 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. Two things. First of all, with regard to the 12B6, we did address the 12B6 issues in the appeal, and certainly Your Honor is correct that in this stage of the litigation, the court should have made all inferences in favor of the appellant and should have...
No, that's not the point. About 12B6. That's equally true at the summary judgment stage.
Well, at a summary judgment stage, the court could have been a trier of fact. The only other thing...
Thank you very much, Mr. Rosen.